Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I'd like to thank the people who make this podcast possible through their subscriptions. Franklin A. Brown Jr., last seen at the check stand in Marin County. Also, Jacqueline Zimmer Jones and two guys named Jeffrey, Jeffrey Adair and Jeffrey Lipinski. You can join those great people on my list. All the info is on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. In our second segment today, we'll be joined by Professor David Coates. He teaches at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. And we're going to get his take on the war on women, the war on religion, and why the war in Afghanistan isn't part of this year's political campaign, at least not so far. But first, how's that police state thing working out for you?
I took a correspondence class in wiretapping and assassination. I learned the lingo and the proper etiquette for covert operation. I got my degree in top secrecy, 'cause I'm gonna be a spy for the CIDIATFBI.
That's Roy Zimmerman, our favorite house band. And to add to the alphabet soup there, let's talk about the NDAA and the HBB, the Homeland Battlefield Bill, which is actually Section 1021 of the NDAA, signed into law by President Obama while he was vacationing in Hawaii last New Year's Eve. Carl Mayer is the attorney who's been on this program many times, fighting for our liberties, our constitutional rights. We did the 8-part series with him about the appeal of the Citizens United decision by the state of Montana and his amicus brief in that case. And he has also been co-counsel in the challenge to the NDAA brought by our friend Chris Hedges, Daniel Ellsberg, and a group of plaintiffs that include Tangerine Boland, who joins us on the program today. Carl and Tangerine, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having us here.
And Carl, I'm going to have to get you some Roy Zimmerman CDs, because I know you really like his take on things, and we'll get him to...
I love Roy Zimmerman, and would love the CDs, and his NSA, I'm Listening, I think, was one
right.
of my favorites.
Well, Carl, if you could take the lead here, I want to first note that I have seen zero coverage in the corporate media about a very important hearing held last week in New York City where you were present, and the first I heard about it was a piece that Tangerine wrote that appeared on a British newspaper website, and then Chris Hedges wrote a piece that was posted on August 13 at the website he writes for, truthdig.com. But I have not seen any ink spilled in the New York Times over this very important hearing regarding the temporary injunction against the detention clause of the NDAA.
Well, that's right, Peter. As usual, if listeners want to go if they want to find and discover on the airwaves real politics and serious issues in this country, they have to listen to Peter B. Collins. You cannot get this information in the New York Times. You cannot get it in the Washington Post. You cannot get it in the Wall Street Journal. You cannot get it in the major radio programs. You certainly can't get it on the networks. And the idea that the presidential campaign would discuss a serious issue is out of the question.
Yeah.
So thankfully, you're covering this and you're on it. We would have called you directly after the hearing, but we were just testing you, Peter, to see how fast you're on it, and you were faster than anyone else on the air as usual. So incredibly important issue, because basically, what the Republican sponsor in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, called this bill the Homeland Battlefield Act, because he said he believes that America is a battlefield. And what we're doing in court is saying, no, America's not a battlefield. America is a constitutional democracy. And as long as it's a constitutional democracy, you cannot have a statute like the NDAA, which Judge Forrest enjoined from taking place, from taking effect back in May. And that was a preliminary injunction. And what we had last week in federal court in Manhattan was a hearing on a permanent injunction. And this was a very important hearing for a couple of reasons. The first being that the government, the President Barack Obama and his administration decided just hours before the hearing that they would in fact appeal the original injunction, which means they're signaling that they will intend to fight for this law, which was a Republican-initiated Big Brother statute, that they will fight for this law all the way to the Supreme Court if they have to. And that's why this fight is so important, and why the work that our plaintiff, Tangerine Bowman, for example, does. If you go to stopndaa.org, you can get updated on the case.
Now, a couple of things here. I think we need to correctly point out the paternity of this ugly piece of legislation that is, in my view, clearly unconstitutional. It's true that it originated with Republicans, but the White House played a double game here, where on the one hand, they acted as if they didn't want the domestic detention powers that are embedded in this in Section 1021. But then we had Senator Levin on the floor of the Senate articulating that it was the White House that insisted that this provision remain in, and that any clarification to state that it couldn't apply to an American citizen in the United States would not be included in the final bill. So the White House has played fast and loose. The president used a signing statement to say that he would never use this authority, and yet his lawyers are in court fighting to preserve his ability to use this authority.
You know, people refer to the signing statement left and right when President Obama issued that shortly after he signed this into law, but it's meaningless. I mean, it's utterly meaningless. It just means I probably won't use this, and that is not binding law. So, and then, you know, he issues that signing statement saying, I have severe reservations about Section 1021, and then turns around in court and tries to, you know, his government attorneys are saying we have no standing, and then if we do have standing, the injunction only applies to us 7 plaintiffs, and so on and so forth. And now they've obviously appealed that injunction. So clearly they want the right to use Section 1021.
Mm-hmm. And Carl, give us a rundown of the discussion before Judge Forrest, and I just want to pause to praise her courage once again, because she is facing down the government lawyers who basically claim that they may or may not abide by her decision. They act as if the executive branch has become supreme, and that they will listen to the articulation of this court if they feel like it.
This is for, and this is why I don't understand why more lawyers and journalists aren't writing about this and participating in this litigation. It's incredibly important, because now both parties have come to the conclusion that when it comes to wartime, and again, this isn't a conventional war, but they're calling it a conflict, and that is giving them license to have the executive branch reign supreme over the other two branches of government. And their position, their legal position, is that the executive branch's decisions should be unquestioned by the judiciary. We see this, for example, in the targeted assassinations, even of American citizens. The Attorney General famously declared that people are entitled to due process, but that doesn't mean judicial process,
yeah.
Which means that whatever process the president wants to give them, that's what they're entitled to. And that's the same. It's the same argument when it comes to the Homeland Battlefield Bill. It is the executive who determines who can be detained in a military prison without trial, without an attorney, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's the boldest expansion of executive power I've seen, certainly in my lifetime, maybe in the history of the country. And it's as if the mainstream media and most attorneys in the country don't care that lawyers, journalists, activists can be sent to prison with no rights. It's really astounding.
Well, it truly is. And Tangerine, take a moment here to describe why you became a plaintiff in this suit against the government. You serve as the executive director of a nonprofit called Revolution Truth. And from what I've seen online, your focus is supporting the work of WikiLeaks and working for open and transparent government at a time when things are moving in exactly the opposite direction.
Correct. And that was one of the primary reasons that I approached Chris Hedges and his attorneys and asked if we could amend this suit to be a multi-plaintiff suit. I had two huge concerns, and I was just basically filled with a sense of dread the moment that Obama signed this into law. And first was WikiLeaks and the fact that I have dealt with them directly and engaged in advocacy for an organization that even Joe Biden has characterized as a terrorist organization, and many pundits have characterized Julian Assange as a spy. So, you know, obviously I would not concur with those assessments, and I am very worried about my liberty after having simply advocated on their behalf. Mm-hmm. Secondly, however, and just as importantly, is the fact that I host online live streaming panel discussions with a range of characters, figures, some very controversial, others not. And we had a global spring series planned with upcoming guests from various countries, including Pakistan, Palestine, multiple countries where we're having issues. And I just was really concerned that not only me, but my entire team could be at risk of indefinite detention with the NDAA.
Mm-hmm.
Just for interviewing people that my government doesn't like.
Right.
Well,
and Carl, if you could weigh in here, this, I think, from Chris Hedges' description and also the piece that Tangerine wrote, what appears to be maddening and somewhat baffling is that when Judge Forrest and I presume you and your legal team ask specific questions like, you know, is Tangerine subject to this law for convening webcasts or other types of conferences with people who are not necessarily identified clearly as terrorists, because the language in this bill is so broad and dragnet inclusive that virtually anyone who steps out of line and is identified by our government could be subject to it.
Yeah, that's right. The judge asked the government attorneys numerous times at the original hearing, can you guarantee that journalists such as Chris Hedges cannot be detained in a military prison without charge and without attorney? The government attorney's response is, no, we can't give that guarantee. Can you guarantee that Daniel Ellsberg and other whistleblowers will not be detained in a military prison without trial and attorney? No, we cannot give that guarantee, was the response of the U.S. government attorneys. And on and on and on about journalists, activists, so it could potentially extend to anyone. And now, also, after that, the government in their papers indicated that certain of the plaintiffs might not be subject to detention, but they didn't firmly state that position on the record, so it's not considered evidence. And beyond that, the government attorney at the hearing, and you had to be at the hearing to listen to this, it was unbelievable. The government attorney said that they don't even keep track of how people are detained by the military, whether it's under the authorization of the statute or not.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Judge Forrest, to her credit, you mean that you could be in contempt of court? And the government didn't deny it. They didn't deny that they could be in contempt of court.
And now let me.
I pray, and I hope that this judge has the fortitude to do what, you know, in the words of Abraham Lincoln, to do her duty as she sees fit, because this is really a crisis for the judiciary if the executive branch can roll over it this way. We're then not any better than a dictatorship.
Carl, explain a little bit the difference between detention under the recently enacted NDAA and detention that might be claimed under the broad authorities granted to the president following 9/11 in the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force.
Well, that statute, which was passed right after 9/11, was directed specifically at the people who participated in the 9/11 attack. It was very narrowly drawn. It was only the people who specifically planned, executed, and assisted the 9/11 attack. But then, all of a sudden, last year, the Congress passed and the President signed this NDAA, or Homeland Battlefield Bill, which includes anyone who gives substantial support to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or associated forces, all these phrases that are meaningless, so meaningless that it can include anyone. It can include journalists, activists, and it's gone so far beyond the original authorization for use of military force as to be unconstitutional and could encompass any American. It could encompass radio hosts like Peter B. Collins. It could encompass New York Times journalists or former New York Times journalists like Chris Hedges. It could encompass lawyers. So this is literally a constitutional crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that the judge stays the course here. And that's why we were in court fighting all day during the 5-hour-plus argument.
And, Carl, just a little bit more about the exchange with the government attorneys. The descriptions that I've read indicate that they came rather ill-prepared to respond to Judge Forrest's questions and operated with a kind of arrogance, saying, well, you know, we may or may not defer to you, Your Honor. And secondly, that there was nothing really new advanced in terms of protecting the rights of American citizens under this sweeping law. So was there anything new from the government? Did they offer any protections for groups of people, for certain types of individuals, in order to try to persuade the judge to lift this injunction?
No, the only thing they carved out, the only thing that was new is that they signaled that they intend to appeal this all the way to the Supreme Court, that they will do everything possible to give the back of a hand to the federal judiciary. It's supposed to be a constitution of three equal parts, a constitutional democracy, three equal parts, the executive branch, the legislative branch, the judicial branch, and this government and the government prior to it, the Bush administration, both of them had the same attitude towards executive power, which is they can do what they want regardless of the judiciary. And that, I think, is a constitutional crisis. And Judge Forrest picked up on that during the hearing. She specifically cited to Federalist number 78, which was authored by Alexander Hamilton, about the importance of separation of powers. And so I hope that the judiciary continues to stand firm here.
Now, Tangerine, in the article that you wrote, you acknowledged that you voted for Barack Obama for president, and I'm not being critical of you for that. I did, too. I have changed this little Obama sticker that says hope that's on my glass door here, and I've added to it, hope you don't put me on the kill list. But I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, let's just be clear before Tangerine responds. Don't blame me. I voted for Ralph Nader. But I would like to hear from the Obama voters what they think now about their vote.
Okay, go ahead, Tangerine.
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think I'm in the minority, and I would have to say there is no way that I can vote for Obama again. Obviously, I cannot vote for a Republican. Republicans are destroying this country, I mean, so quickly. They could care less about the poor and middle class, and that it's just revolting. So, or about facts, all too often. So, you know, if I had my way, I would call for a national vote of no confidence this coming November, preceded by 10 demands of this government to start restoring accountability and transparency. Now, obviously, it would take an enormous amount of work, and I don't know that that's going to happen in time. But, you know, I'm disgusted, and I'm, you know, I've grieved a lot for who I thought Obama was, and I guess I was just terribly wrong. Now, I would add a caveat that I think that the American public is incredibly difficult. I think we're all too easily misled. We're underinformed and undereducated all too often about the actual issues, and that's a systemic problem. That's mainstream media. That's all kinds of things. And I would say that no one person can do the kind of job we expect our president to do. And so I don't think Obama has been wrong as so many people have made him out to be. But on this front, I mean, it's been egregious. So I'm disgusted also with my fellow Democrats who lack the courage and the backbone to tell the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think actually Democrats are selling us all down the river by failing to have that integrity and that courage, because what we're doing is we're hollowing out our very party. We're hollowing out and discarding the principles upon which we're founded. And I would say I'm a Democrat trying to reclaim my party. So,
well, Tangerine, I share your frustrations, and I watched Obama. I saw him speak four times during the campaign, and I was able to detect that he was very clever and that he was providing this big blank canvas for us to project our wishes and our desires, our aspirations on. Yeah. But I felt that as a fairly cynical guy who's been watching politics for 40, 45 years, that I had lowered my expectations appropriately. What I never expected was that this guy, who was a constitutional law teacher at the college level, would be so grotesque in turning the Constitution on its ear. I've done a lot of work on the surveillance state that has been created. And just most recently, I talked to Diane Rourke, who is a former member, a top-ranking staffer on the House Intelligence Committee. And she flatly says that the massive wiretapping program that continues with Obama's control is not only wrong, but unnecessary. And so we've got a real conflict, but I agree with you that one of the most dangerous aspects of this is that Democrats have gone silent because it's their guy who's in the White House. And recently I talked to Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink for Peace. And she said that at the height of the anti-war effort under Bush, that there were 242 chapters across the country. Thousands of people had joined Code Pink for Peace. And today, it's down to a couple of dozen chapters, and I don't know the exact count of people who consider themselves members. But it's very clear that Democrats have gone silent and either appear indifferent or oblivious to the dramatic changes that are occurring under their president.
Yes, exactly. And I think, again, it's this sort of collective sense of fear that, you know, we're back to the I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils, and I'm going to shut up about this, and I'm going to get very angry at my, at other Democrats who dare to speak out against this. And I mean, I just was viciously attacked online yesterday for posting something about Obama's civil liberties record by a fellow Democrat. And I think it's time to get a backbone, a collective backbone in this country, and to stand up for our values and for integrity and for honesty. And that may sound naive, but I actually think that it's absolutely imperative. I think it's imperative for the future of this planet, not to mention politics, that we recover a sense of integrity and truthfulness about what we're facing and what we're doing. So,
and we also have a media that is collaborating with the expansion of the police state in this country. And I'll just give you one example that surfaced for me today. On July 25th, there were a series of coordinated FBI raids against individuals who call themselves anarchists and who were aligned with the Occupy movement. And these people were subjected to pre-dawn raids with, 80 officers packing automatic weapons. They used a battering ram to break into this guy's house where he is sleeping and is unarmed. And they did not arrest him or detain him under the NDAA, but they confiscated his computers and his personal papers. And this is part of a pattern that has been going on for a year and a half now of crackdowns on individuals who really are exercising their First Amendment rights. And not only is there very little coverage of these KGB-style raids, but there appears to be very little reaction when people do learn about them. Carl?
Yeah, I think that that's largely correct, and it's not just the activists that are targeted. There have been more prosecutions of whistleblowers and journalists under the Obama administration than under the Espionage Act. Than all of the five prior administrations combined. You have the expansion of drones over American airspace. Last year, for the first time, there were 106 permits were requested from the FAA to from various levels of government to fly drones over American airspace.
Mm-hmm.
And that is on top of the wiretapping. It's on top of the USA Patriot Act, which allows the government to go through the library records and other personal records of people. And put together, this represents the greatest assault on civil liberties in our country since the McCarthy era. And the only difference is that there were some Democrats who would stand up during the McCarthy era, and now there are virtually none, with a handful of exceptions.
Yeah.
So it has to be up to us to do this.
And Tangerine, you're based in Oregon, and I will say that your senators, Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley, neither is perfect, but they are raising important issues. Wyden in particular is in this bizarre game with the Director of National Intelligence, where DNI issued him a memo about what he could or couldn't say about grave concerns he has about what he describes as an alternate interpretation of the Patriot Act that would make us all scream if we knew about it. Besides those senators from Oregon, the silence is just deafening across the country.
It really is, and I do have to say kudos to both of my senators here, and I did just ask one of them to please run for president in 2016, and that's Ron Wyden, and because he doesn't back down. Both of them have so much integrity, and they're both challenging SOPA and CISPA and the NDAA. I mean, they're not, these guys, you know, they see what we're seeing. They're seeing the facts and the assault on the rule of law, the perversion of the rule of law and the assault on the U.S. Constitution. So, you know, there are a few rare gems left who, you know, have the guts and integrity to do the right thing. And unfortunately, you know, they are few and far between. So, you know, we have our work cut out for us.
Indeed. So, Carl, you've got your work cut out for you. What are the next steps as the Justice Department, I guess I have to put that in air quotes, the Justice Department is planning to further appeal the temporary injunction? What's the next?
They can't really appeal anything until the judge decides whether or not to make the temporary injunction permanent.
Okay.
She makes it permanent, which is what we have our fingers and toes crossed that she will do. She makes it permanent. In that case, they could then appeal that permanent injunction. If she doesn't and decides to lift the injunction, then it might be up to us to appeal. But mm-hmm. we're in a holding pattern here waiting for her. This judge, she wrote a spectacular opinion that everyone should read. I believe you can get it at the stopndaa.org website.
Yeah.
And find her opinion there. And we're waiting for her to deliver her next opinion, and we hope this will be an even greater principled tome that stands up for democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter, I really want to thank you for having me on today. I'm gonna have to run to take another call. I always want to be available to the Peter Collins Show.
Well, you're very gracious. You're released with no guilt. Thank you, Carl.
Thank you, Peter. I'll let Tangerine finish up.
Okay.
And we'll talk later, and we'll be happy to update you on this as well.
Yeah, keep me posted, particularly when Judge Forrest issues her next decision.
Will do.
All right.
Thank
that's
you again.
That's Carl Mayer here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And Tangerine, I'm about ready to wrap up, but I'd like to give you an opportunity just to talk about your own feelings as a plaintiff in this case who has put yourself forward, because you're basically identifying yourself as somebody who might be subject to this law. That takes a level of courage that I want to thank you for. But tell me how it feels to see these proceedings continue and to see the Obama administration's attorneys fight against your battle for our constitutional rights.
Well, I have to say, when I first approached the attorneys and we did amend the suit and I joined as a plaintiff, I was just terrified. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very likely the subject of the secret grand jury investigation because I've been in direct contact with WikiLeaks. And I lack the rights to even understand what is being investigated about me. And yet I'm, you know, one of the most transparent, law-abiding people you would ever meet. So it's just surreal to even be going through this. And I have to say, though, as time has gone on, and fortunately I was able to attend the hearings in March in New York, and to witness firsthand what we're fighting for, and to see the arrogance and the condescension and the expectation that we would all just roll over, on the side of the government attorneys, versus the dedication and the smarts of our attorneys and every plaintiff, I felt a level of hopefulness, you know, regardless of the outcome. And obviously we need the outcome to be a permanent injunction that stands. But just, I have to say, along the way, though, I've been given a sense of hope that I've lacked for quite some time, and that is because I have decided unequivocally to stand by my own values and principles,
mm-hmm.
and it's strengthened me as a person, and I think I could probably safely say that about all of us. It's life-changing to do this, and I would just really encourage other people to stand up as well and to do so, you know, strategically and intelligently, and to just stick by their principles. Because hopefully, in the end, we do win.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. That's a message of inspiration coming from somebody who's deep in the belly of this proverbial beast, and I thank you for that. And Tangerine, aside from flaming emails from Democrats who don't really want to face the truth about Obama, what kind of reactions have you gotten since you gained visibility as a plaintiff in this suit?
Well, they're starkly opposed, and the two primary things I can think of are, one, there's been an outpouring of gratitude from people around the world. I mean, literally, probably a couple dozen countries and hundreds of people, and more so every day. And people thank us, me and my co-plaintiffs and our attorneys, on behalf of themselves, their countries, and their children. On the other side of that spectrum is the latest government brief. And that brief attempted to paint me and my co-plaintiffs as enemies of the United States, as delusional, irrational, and as our case as having zero merit. And it's so offensive. I mean, I have a master's degree. I was doing a PhD in public policy and governance, and yet these people want to characterize, I mean, Chris Hedges, the author of 11 books, as irrational and delusional.
Yeah.
So it's, I think that right there, those two different reactions show the truth that the public is engaged in, and the lies that the United States government has embedded itself in. So,
well, Tangerine, I just like to join the legions of people who support what you're doing, and I'd like you to push it all the way until we get a clear definition of the restoration of our rights as American citizens. And it's going to be a long slog. There's a lot to fight over.
There is, and no worries on that front. We're committed to this.
Tangerine Boland, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Peter.
Presidential elections are planned distractions to divert attention from the action behind the scenes. Like a game of chess when the house is a mess, or a petty money squabble when your marriage is in trouble, or a football game there's rioting in the streets. It's just another movie, another song and dance, another poor sucker who never had a chance.
Ah, the musical drama called Presidential Election 2012 is underway, and some of the soundtrack comes from Mitt Romney himself. Amazing to see his off-key singing of American anthems replayed in Obama campaign commercials, but it is a wild ride this year. And we welcome back to our program Professor David Coates from Wake Forest University. He's the author of Making the Progressive Case and has been talking with me over the last few years about language and framing and the way progressives often fail to properly articulate their positions and arguments. David Coates, great to talk to you again.
Nice to be with you again, Peter.
And there's so much going on. You're there in North Carolina, where the Obama convention, the re-coronation, will be taking place in just a few weeks. Is there a buzz about that?
Well, there is a buzz about that. I think certainly inside the local Democratic Party, of course, it's very exciting to have everybody here. But also, of course, it's critical for the Obama campaign because the North Carolina was won by 0.3% in 2008. And Joe Biden, I think, has been given responsibility to make sure they win the campaign here again. So we find ourselves very much in the crosshairs, really, of the whole exercise. The Republicans think they can pull this state back. Democrats are desperate to hold it, and 15 electoral votes are at stake.
And as our man on the scene, I don't expect you to make a prediction, but what are your feelings? Do you think it's possible?
The Democrats have a really uphill struggle. I mean, right now, certainly as far as I can tell, the general message coming from Washington is let's recreate the grassroots enthusiasm that was there in 2008. And you just can't do that. It's not enough. You know, that they can't do that. I mean, they came in as the candidates of change, really, and one, I think, in large measure, partly as an anti-Bush vote, and partly because in crucial parts of this state, at least I think of others, they elected very conservative Democrats who were kind of blue dog Democrats who took over in Republican parts of the state that just couldn't bear Bush anymore and found Palin, I think, particularly unappealing. All that's gone. Now this election is all about Barack Obama's record, and though he can legitimately argue, well, it would have been worse if McCain had been in and we took a terrible condition and we made it slightly better, it's a very difficult package to sell. So we're engaged in defensive politics for Obama in North Carolina. Speaking privately, you know, I'm not wildly optimistic.
Yeah. No, I share your concern, and I also look at the bigger picture. That by operating or by citing the convention in a right to work state with a recent history of Tea Party development there, that it not only is probably going to come up short in terms of using the convention to deliver the state of North Carolina, but I think a lot of messages will be sent to union members and others arrayed around progressive issues, that the president doesn't really care so much about those issues. It's a just win, baby situation.
Well, you know, there are these three rather critical constituencies, aren't there, that they're in play between the parties. I mean, one is white voters in the South, period. One is kind of a northern white working class. And the other really is kind of Northern Catholics, I think. I mean, the thing you always feel in the South, you know, is that religion plays a huge role here in politics. And there's a sense, perhaps I speak slightly too generally, but I have a sense that Catholics are often treated not as proper Christians down here. So, you know, in a way, the arrival of this convention here at least alerts us the fact that in simple electoral terms, the Obama campaign has a serious set of issues to deal with highly conservative groups who you might normally expect to be quite naturally on the progressive side. And because of all the Reaganite policies of the last 30 years and things that are going on since the financial crisis, I mean, those votes are very, very precarious.
And from your post there at Wake Forest and, in North Carolina, who's winning the war on religion right now?
Well, I assume God is, actually. But look, you live on one planet and I live on another. I mean, the depth of religious commitment around here is enormous. And it is largely Protestant and fundamentalist, I think, evangelical. And though that historically was a political tradition that supported progressive causes, in the last 30 years, it's been turned entirely on its head. So I rather fear that what we've got here, I'm sure you see this from a distance too, is a highly mobilized right-wing evangelical Protestant Republican base and a rather disillusioned and slightly less enthusiastic Democratic one. Now, of course, every time somebody like Michelle Obama sweeps through this state, enthusiasm in the activist ranks of the party surges for a while, and I'm sure the fear of a complete Republican sweep in November will get people active again, but it isn't the same level of enthusiasm on the left that it is now on the right.
Well, and it's going to be interesting to see in terms of intensity, resonance, and propulsion to voter turnout how these dueling characterizations of a so-called war on women, as the progressives characterize it, or the so-called war on religion, as Christianists of all kind, including the highly politicized Roman Catholic bishops.
Sure.
And it's to me, it's fascinating to see these issues presented in the manner that they are. I never thought, David Coates, that in my lifetime we would see a replay of struggles over contraception.
No, and nor did I. I mean, these things have a way of coming out of right field in ways you don't expect. I mean, I'm sure that your sense in California, certainly my sense here, is that the basic issues at play here are about the economy. So we've not quite gone back to the gays, guns, and God, John Kerry kind of Bush confrontation. But in the margins of that conversation about the economy are these highly conservative additional elements that actually corrode the capacity of women to live their lives fully, of people who are not heterosexual to have as equal rights as those that do, and also immigrant groups really being put to the sword. So I think part of the job between now and November is not only to catalyze those groups in favor of at least a defensive vote against the Republicans, but also to break the credibility gap. I mean, to make people believe again that actually, if an Obama administration comes in for a second term, it will do something serious in favor of these groups.
David, I've got a couple of press releases from AstroTurf groups that I'd like to introduce as evidence here.
Okay.
Exhibit A came in my email today from a group that calls itself, let me get it right here, Colorado's Future Project, which is supported by the Independent Women's Forum. And this press release is responding to Obama's campaign appearance in Denver today, where he's being introduced by Sandra Fluke or Fluke.
Yes, I thought she was doing that.
Yes. And she, of course, is the Georgetown University law student who was singled out for abuse by Rush Limbaugh and caused a lot of problems for Limbaugh, gratefully. And it has created an interesting way of rallying women and progressives to the president's cause.
Mm-hmm.
So here comes this press release, and I'm going to read it to you, including a very interesting typographical error that they didn't bother to correct. Krista Kafer of Colorado's Future Project blasts the Obama campaign's use of Sandra Fluke, the 2012 Georgetown law graduate and free contraception crusader, and birth control as a patronizing and offensive way to reach women in her hometown of Denver. Kafer, executive director of Colorado's Future Project, and a single woman, that's what it reads, a single woman, issued the following statement. Well, I didn't have time to track down the Colorado's Future Project or the Independent Women's Forum. But this is clearly one of these AstroTurf groups, which is probably funded by either Rove's group, the Chamber of Commerce, or the Koch brothers, maybe all of the above. And the spin that they're putting on this is that President Obama, the quote is that his entire approach to attracting the female vote in Colorado lies below the belt. All right?
Right.
So that is a very crude way of describing the issues of reproductive rights. And this is allegedly a woman who says that, you know, women aren't single-issue voters. We care about jobs and the economy and the deficits more than we care about birth control. And I find this a fascinating attempt to spin these issues, and I wanted to get your comment.
Well, I think they're pushing against a closed door on that, to be honest. My sense is that, oh, this might get me into trouble, too. I mean, the problem in the American electorate is not women voters. Women voters are incredibly intelligent in the main, and they live the daily reality of trying to balance family budgets, of handling reproductive issues, of dealing with a patriarchal culture that doesn't leave them alone. I think the biggest problem we have are with the gun shooting, deer hunting, men, to be honest, you know, and it's quite clear that, you know, everybody is under huge pressure economically, in personal terms, you know, that wages are down, that jobs are insecure, that houses are being foreclosed, and so on. So everybody is looking to the government, to the election, to see what is being said. But women live on a daily basis the reality of a healthcare system that doesn't treat them as equal citizens. And I think the Republicans are charging themselves up a blind alley if they want to play that kind of politics. And I think that will bite them very hard. I hope it does. And so all the data would suggest that Obama and the Democrats are holding their electoral advantage amongst women. It's amongst white working class guys in particular.
Well, I do agree with you that gun issues are a problem, and it explains the silence of the president despite these recent mass killings. But coming back to contraception,
okay,
I mean, when Rick Santorum first raised this last fall, I laughed. I said, how on earth can anybody gain traction by being against birth control? And, you know, when you tie it together with the pro-life community, birth control should be a no-brainer. No one's ever forced to take birth control or to use contraceptives, but it would, very clearly reduce the propensity for an abortion from an unwanted pregnancy.
Yeah.
On that simple notion alone, this should be a non-starter. But here we have Sandra Fluck once again being called a crusader for free contraception. What kind of bullshit is that?
Well, yes, I mean, it ties into a certain reading of the Bible, doesn't it? So there's a strand of fundamentalist Protestantism that will go back and cherry-pick the Bible, very much cherry-pick the Bible, but will then turn around and basically push a very patriarchal agenda. And there are, I mean, you will know this. I mean, I've experienced over many years. I mean, women negotiating their way through this particular minefield. Some women do settle back into an acceptance of traditional gender roles, but that seems to me to be almost entirely generational. You know, the vast majority of young women, sexually active young women, definitely do not. 90% is it? 97% of all practicing Catholic women actually practice birth control and so on. The figures are very dramatically high.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I mean, what Rush Limbaugh and that idiocy will say, what a few token women that are dragged out from behind some upper middle class bush will say, it is one thing. But actually, the vast majority of women, I think, will not respond to that. That will not be the thing that determines their vote. If it does, it will actually pull them in a progressive direction. So again, and maybe this is a mistake on my part, but I don't worry about that. I think the more the Republicans push that, except in certain sections of the South, the more they'll lose as a result.
Now, David, I have Exhibit 2 here in AstroTurf Propaganda, and this one is really interesting and insidious. It is allegedly from a conservative group called Nevada Hispanics. That is an initiative of American Principles in Action, and I did look them up. They are a deep evangelical Republican group. Not clear where their funding comes from. I wasn't able to suss that out. But they are announcing that starting today, they are running a 30-second TV spot in Las Vegas on the Spanish language program station Univision. And it is in Spanish. And it reads, "Do not be fooled by President Obama's words. He's not committed to immigrants. He only wants our vote. And with the election on the line, he offers our undocumented youth a temporary solution that still cheats them of legal status.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't he keep his promise to push immigration reform? Instead, Obama has deported more people than any other president in this country's history. With friends like these, who needs enemies? In November, make your vote count." Now, what I find insidious about this is a Republican message aimed at Hispanic voters, and it is hammering the president for being lukewarm on the DREAM Act, which he basically has imposed via executive orders, and of being the guy who deported more non-citizens than anybody before him. Now, that is actually a fact.
It is.
But it's fascinating to see Republicans embrace any message to any group that will advance their interests, because this is totally contradictory to the anti-amnesty position that they even try to stretch into this administrative extension of a DREAM Act-like policy. And then they certainly are in favor of deporting as many non-citizens as possible, but they're not afraid to use that to hammer Obama if they think it'll win them votes in a swing state.
Well, I mean, two things are going on, aren't they? I mean, one is that the administration came in with this commitment to bipartisan politics, and so in the first two and a half years of the first term, this three-legged stool policy, which the immigration secretary, John Napolitano, announced,
right,
which was, you know, tighter security on the border, expulsion of illegal immigrants, and full immigration reform. Those three were offered as a package to try and draw the Republicans into a deal on immigration reform. And that wasn't so crazy, because that was exactly the same policy which McCain and Martinez and Hagel and even George Bush, too, had actually pushed as well.
Right.
What, in fact, they found, of course, as we know, is that this new body of Republicans won't do bipartisanship under any circumstances whatsoever, so you end up with this lousy record of actually expelling more people than the Bush people did, but without delivering immigration reform. And so what's happened to the on this, like on home foreclosures, is that the Obama administration in the last 12 months has gone into reverse and has picked up where it should have started and has decided, no, we'll do our own private version of the Dream Act. So there's that. That's one of the elements we have to deal with. The other one, which you mentioned and which has to be thrown to sharp relief, is the reason they don't have immigration reform is not the Democrats, it's the Republicans. Republicans have actually refused to go along with any kind of reform policy on immigration, as they have on so many other things. So the job of progressives, I think, in what is essentially a defensive campaign, I think, because the thought of a Republicans controlling the White House, both houses of Congress and the Supreme Court is just a nightmare, is actually to reemphasize that the reason why Obama has underperformed is less about his conservatism, well, that's an element we might want to talk about, but more about the resistance which he's met from Republicans in Congress both before and after the midterms. If there's an impasse in Washington now on which Republicans are claiming Obama should be rejected, it's an impasse they themselves have created.
David, I will commend the president because I feel that on the stump in recent weeks, he has finally come to the position of drawing clear distinctions between his economic policies, the failed policies of Bush, which Romney embraces as just give him another chance. And you and I talked about this about a year ago when Drew Weston published a strong op-ed in a Sunday New York Times where he criticized the president for failing from day one to label those failed policies as Bush policies, as Republican policies. And I feel that his campaign message is more on target and more effective than he has been for most of this first term on those very significant differences.
Well, I think you and I, when we talk, we normally have fairly high levels of agreement. Can I just push you an inch further on that?
Oh, go ahead.
I'm just drafting an op-ed now. It'll be in the Huffington Post on Friday, I hope, saying yes, but yes, but. In other words, it's quite clear that he's drawing sharp lines between himself and Romney, but he's still vulnerable to this counter-assault from Romney, because the lines that are being drawn are ones in which Obama is saying, I and Joe Biden and the Democratic Party will defend the middle class and will look after middle class interests. And two things are happening. One is Romney says, well, I will too. And anyway, you haven't done very well defending them thus far. So you've seen all these adverts. I've been watching the Olympics, and they've been pouring out these adverts of poor, unemployed Americans looking miserable, saying, mm-hmm, Obama's let us down. So what Obama's also got to do, I think, is to go the extra inch, which I think we might yet get him to do, which is to say, look, there have been two great periods of economic growth in America since the Second World War. One, the New Deal growth period through the 50s and 60s, led by the Democrats, in which middle-class living standards grew on the basis of a strong manufacturing base. And the post-1980 Reagan period, in which middle-class living standards survived only by sending everybody out to work, working longer hours, and maxing out your credit cards. Now, that second strategy is dead. That's what Romney's offering you more of. And this time, the resolution of its contradictions is going to be resolved by cutting the welfare net, you know, take taxes off the rich, but get rid of genuine Medicare and Medicaid. So that is an entirely bankrupt strategy. What we as Democrats have got to do is to go back and mine the strengths of that first period, which had one, as you remember, huge weakness. It excluded the rural and urban poor, so African America was largely excluded from that prosperity in the 50s and 60s. But we've got to go back to a model based on strong trade unions, strong manufacturing base, rising middle class living standards, and greater income equality. If, you know, Obama's got to present himself as a much more radical candidate. Now, I rather suspect that in part of his soul he is. You know, I think this is a credible development, but if we don't do that, if he just goes out there and says, look, I will look after the middle class better the second time than I did the first, a lot of independent voters are going to say, well, you know, you try, you fail, let's try somebody new. And the terrible danger is we get a series of one-term presidents led by Romney, whose proposals are a nightmare, and he'll be out 4 years later and somebody else will be in. And we get into this period where people get more and more depressed about the state of American politics and they back away from it. And then the Koch brothers have a field day because they're the only ones left in town with the money. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a critical election now, and Obama has to do something more. And the first thing he has to do is to read my op-ed on the Huffington Post.
And then the second is to fire Tim Geithner.
Yes, send some people to the wall. Get rid of Sumners, they've done that. Get rid of Geithner. You know, why are we not really buying? Get some more radical people in. If you go back to the first New Deal, as you sure you know, it failed miserably and was blocked by conservatives in the Supreme Court. So Roosevelt went to the country, won this second great election, and then you got a genuine second New Deal, which actually worked. And admittedly, had the help of the Second World War to fully implement it. We've got to find a peaceful way of implementing its positives. But actually, Obama has a chance to trigger a second go, and I think that's what this election's got to be about.
Well, and I think the other thing that he and David Axelrod are counting on is just how out of touch and off key, not only in his singing voice, Mitt Romney is.
Yeah.
And so this new initiative to claim that Obama is eviscerating the welfare reforms of Bill Clinton by allowing state level waivers, which of course Romney got one in 2005, I think that it's really an off-base hit. Now, I understand he's trying to reach white working families who still think that most people on welfare are not white. Not true, but that's
what they think.
That's the perception that they have.
Sure.
But I think that it drives a more important negative message about Romney, that here in the depths of the worst recession, and it's a depression if you're unemployed, since the 1930s, he is playing a class game that is I think, going to produce a backlash. And by having, you know, this wealthy guy who pays 14.2% in tax and has all this money, all these offshore accounts, for him to be talking about making welfare recipients work when there is no work is almost as off base as, Newt Gingrich's effort to tag Obama as the food stamp president mentioning why so many people are on food stamps.
Well, I'm with you on that, and I think that for that reason, and for others probably, the three presidential debates are going to be very critical, because I can't imagine for a minute that Obama won't completely clear the floor with Romney, because his positions are so inconsistent and his own personal charisma is so absent. But you can see a situation developing, can't you, in which maybe Obama will become a second-term president, but unless we bring in on his coattails a liberal Congress again, we get the House back, then we're just going to face two more years of the impasse that we've had before. So I think Obama has a bigger job to do than just pointing out what a useless candidate Mitt Romney is. I think the Republicans are fairly conscious of that already, but they're hatred of Obama is so deep in certain quarters that they'll put up with Romney anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We've got to really work very hard to get various Tea Party Republicans out of the House, you know, in these crucial key state elections.
Now, David, we've talked about these rhetorical wars on women, on religion, now on welfare recipients or just people who happen to be in poverty. But I'm very concerned that the real wars and the expansion of our military footprint by President Obama are not being discussed. There was a little coverage of foreign policy issues while Romney was in Israel, but it was simply to see who could out-Zionist the other. And we've got, you know, we can, even though there are stories now about how we're packing up to leave Afghanistan, everybody knows that that's phony, and that we're drawing down the forces that were inserted since 2009, but that at least 50, if not 75,000 American troops will be there for the next few years, and Obama has committed to an American presence and American financial support until 2024.
Yeah.
And so, you know, beyond that, we have the killer capture program, which I think is grossly unconstitutional. We have the use of drones to expand our war footprint, even beyond Pakistan, now in Yemen, Somalia. We're chasing Joseph Kony, we say, in Central Africa. And so I'm extremely concerned that this Democratic president has done more to expand not only presidential power for unilateral war making, but our commitments to multiple fronts in dicey situations all around the world, and that most Americans are oblivious to it.
Yes. Okay. First of all, that was a question so much as a statement.
Yeah, is there a question in there? If you can find it, go ahead and answer it.
Because you find yourself in all these elections in a choice between two things you would not actually wish to choose between. I mean, the conversation we've had so far points out, I think, that the election of Romney and a full Republican Congress would make the life of the American poor and indeed the bulk of the American middle class extraordinarily precarious. So we do need to get Obama back. But part of the reason, it seems to me, and you know this from the stuff I've written too, of why it's so difficult to get a Democratic, solid progressive Democratic majority is we are at a critical transition moment in the American empire. You know, we are at a cusp, and we have got to pull back from our imperial commitments and bring our people home and stop thinking that we can run the world and that we can kill people arbitrarily simply because we've got the technology that's capable of doing it. And yet, ironically, the Obama solution to the attacks of 9/11 was actually to extend our imperial footprint, as you say, further into areas in which we now need to retreat. So I think when this election is over, but possibly not before because of the domestic reasons, we should launch a huge campaign to get the American imperial project into the public debate and to start to argue strongly that our expansion abroad is not only immoral and unnecessary, but it's actually destructive of our prosperity at home. And that's a conversation that can only come from progressives within the broad Democratic Party coalition.
And David,
we will be hammered for by Rush Limbaugh and co as defeatists and declinists and mm-hmm. so on, when in fact what we're saying is unless you actually start doing this stuff, we will decline for sure.
But one of the problems was pointed up in a recent conversation I had with Medea Benjamin. She's the co-founder of Code Pink for Peace.
Yeah.
And in 2008, they had something like 240 chapters across the country and thousands of members.
Right.
And in the last few years, most of those people have gone silent. They have fewer than two dozen chapters. And I don't know the membership ranks, but it has shrunken dramatically. And that's just one symptom of the shift where there were people who were against the war because it was Bush's war. And because it's Obama's war, there are a lot of people who say, well, not my problem.
Yeah. I think maybe one of the things that might trigger this conversation immediately after the election is the whole business of the automatic cutting of public spending, you know, that the Republicans signed up to. I mean, if in fact we find ourselves in a situation where the Congress is having to decide, does the military budget get cut? Right. Automatically, there's going to be a very large conversation, I think, about the role of the United States in the world. And it has these two faces, doesn't it? It has a business of how we relate to the outside world. And if you want to, and if you have time, we should talk about the Olympics, because I am truly horrified by what I've seen there in relation to our projection of ourselves abroad even in something as neutral as sport. But if you bring it back inside the United States, one of the problems we have is if you start slashing the military budget very dramatically, then unemployment in key manufacturing areas is going to take another hit. So one of the jobs we've got to do is to find a way, which was found very effectively in the late 1940s by the New Dealers, of converting a wartime economy into a peacetime economy, and the left needs to be talking about that. I mean, there are so many things we need to make and build, from roads and schools and so on, that building fighter airplanes is an obscenity. And yet we are nowhere in the political conversation, certainly in Washington, but I think nationally, is that are those kind of choices being widely discussed, and they certainly need to be.
Well, I'm pretty cynical about this, David. I believe that the lame duck session of Congress will not follow through with the $50 billion in annual cuts to defense, and instead they will whack it out of entitlements and out of the 12% of discretionary non-defense spending, which, of course, is insufficient to reach the targets that they have for deficit reduction.
Yeah. Well, you know, we'll be caught in our usual dilemmas there, because the deficit reduction isn't necessary anyway. I mean, actually, right now, borrowing is about as cheap as it can be. The question is, what do you borrow for, you know? And here we are with bridges rotting and schools collapsing and industrial policy being generally on the civilian side abandoned. And in fact, those are all the things we desperately need. And we need it nationally, I think. But if I drive across North Carolina, I weep sometimes. The level of poverty and the isolation people have stuck in villages, they can't get out to decent work and so on. And yet we can bomb and shoot our way around other parts of the world with gay abandon. So, I mean, the priorities in this state, in this country, are really very much out of whack. And unless people on the left start to argue strongly that they are, they're going to stay out of whack, aren't they?
Well, and Obama has a campaign commercial running warning people that Romney wants to increase defense spending. Whoa, I'm getting lost.
You know, hypocrisy is not a monopoly of one side.
No, I'm getting lost in the spin.
No.
David, as we wrap up, give us your thoughts about the Olympics, and in particular, the jingoistic way they are presented on American television.
It's truly ghastly, actually. I mean, I grew up, as you can tell from my accent, people can tell my accent, in the United Kingdom, and of course there's a level of jingoism in all of these presentations, but the whole Olympic idea is that we enjoy the athletes, you know, and we enjoy the struggle, and we honor those who lose as well as those who win. Now, that's the whole Olympic idea. And none of that happens in prime time. In prime time, it's entirely about American winners. We never even see American losers unless they lose in some dramatic fashion. And I've got to the point where I just have to turn it off, even though I have a great love of athletics in particular. I'm rowing because I can't take it anymore. And it just speaks to something, an insensitivity, I think, which, of course, imperial powers, including the British long ago, have about their impact on the rest of the world. And we suffer badly from that, I think. You know, we would do well to walk quietly and speak humbly. And then we would find we had more friends. Soft power is much better than hard power in so many ways. And the coverage of the Olympics just speaks to the self-delusions of imperialism, I think, which we will pay a high price for if we don't begin initially, rapidly, to shed.
Well, and I fully agree with you. I will just add that I'm a lightweight sports fan, but I enjoy the Olympics. I like swimming a lot and some of the track and field events. And I have not been paying close attention. You know, I turn it on for a couple of hours at night. But what I notice is how much NBC is focusing on every minute of the female beach volleyball competition.
That's and, because they're dressed so well, yes.
Well, sometimes. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Misty and Carrie are getting more primetime coverage than so many other events. And, you know, I understand exactly what it's about. It's about ratings, and would you rather look at some, you know, hard-body women out there playing volleyball in very skimpy bikinis? You know, or some muscle-bound guy trying to bench press 400 pounds.
Well, it brings us back to the patriarchal issues we began to our conversation on.
Yeah.
I mean, the two come around in a full circle. It is really disgraceful, and I'm quite angry about it. I've never seen it done quite as badly as this, and I think NBC has a lot of explaining to do for their primetime coverage. It really is offensive.
Well, the explaining they will do will be to shareholders, and they will crow about the billion-dollar profits that they made jamming us with all those commercials in between the Olympic events.
It just shows how nasty capitalism can be, doesn't it, really?
Yeah. Well, David, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. David Coates, professor at Wake Forest University and the author of Making the Progressive Case. Thank you, David.
Nice to talk to you. Goodbye.
Thanks for joining me today. I welcome your comments. Drop me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until